Well, thank you very much, everybody, for coming to our meeting tonight. And thank you for your support during the whole year. This is our last meeting, although there are a couple of other things that are happening before the season finishes for the Ulster Medical Society, and I'll mention those at the end of tonight's meeting. But it's good to see you all out this evening. This is a joint meeting that we have with the Ulster Society for the History of Medicine, whose chairman is Dr. Robert Montgomery, who's here. And we're really looking forward to hearing David Stewart. So thank you very much for coming, and I'm going to hand over now for Dr. Montgomery to introduce David. Thanks.
Thank you, Professor Atkinson. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you all here this evening and offer a special welcome to our 2010 Professor Gary Love Lecturer, Dr. David Stewart. Can I thank Professor Atkinson and the officers of the Ulster Medical Society for their cooperation and help in arranging our joint meeting. Dr. Stewart has been the Medical Director of the Regulation and Quality Improvement Authority in Northern Ireland since November 2007. Prior to that, he was the Director of Public Health at the Eastern Health and Social Services Board, a remit which included the great city and port of Belfast. Following the untimely death of Professor Love in 2002, David succeeded him as the chair of CREST, the body which would later amalgamate in 2007 into the Guidelines and Audit Implementation Network, known as GAIN. He is the vice chair of GAIN. When we provided the student selected component in the history of medicine in second year medicine, one session in each term was given by David on the history of public health in Belfast. Following his talk, he would take the students on a walking tour of the sites of interest to medical historians in the city centre. This became one of the most popular features of the course. So this evening, the subject for our lecture is Building a Healthy City for the 21st Century, Lessons from Victorian Belfast. Okay, thank you, David.
Thank you. I'll just try and get the... Here we go. Here we go. Well, good evening, everyone, and I'd like, first of all, to thank Brew and Robert for their kind welcome this evening. I'd also like to thank both societies who have invited me this evening to present the 2010 Professor Gary Love Lecture. The Ulster Society for History of Medicine, my involvement with them has been over a number of years, and I have to say I really do commend the Society for promotion of the aspect of history of medicine here in Northern Ireland, and they have run a very successful student selected component at which I've been privileged to be involved with from the start. And certainly I think that the whole aspect of bringing history to students is a very vital part of the course, and actually it really helps to set the scene for students. But I'm also particularly pleased to have been invited by the Ulster Medical Society to present this lecture. Some of the people I will be talking about this evening were very really instrumental in the establishment of this society. Some of them you will have heard about before in lectures previously, I think, in relation to their clinical work, but tonight I'm going to focus very much on public health and their public health roles. But in particular this evening, I do feel it's a great privilege to be asked to present the 2010 Professor Gary Love Lecture. I'm sure, like a number of people in the room, I first came across Gary when I was a medical student. His lectures were eagerly awaited by students, which I have to say was not always the case in all his lectures. But I think in particular, his teaching ward rounds in wards 3 and 4, I think in the words, I suppose, of my daughters, he was a legend. I mean, people really did want to go on those ward rounds because I think the quality of his teaching was superb. But personally, I think, really got to know Gary, as Robert said, when CREST was established. CREST was established in 1988, and Gary and Philip McClements at the department had this idea of bringing together a group of doctors who would be interested in improving clinical efficiency. You'll note the word was efficiency. As times have moved on, I think we've moved more into evidence-based practice, but at the start our interest was very much on the efficiency of care. There are at least one or two people in the room who I spot who actually were members of CREST in the early days, and I think they will recall that we were invited to come along to CREST, but not to represent anybody. We were specifically selected and told because it was considered that this group of doctors would be enthusiastic and would be interested in promoting clinical efficiency. I have to say, throughout the years of CREST, this, of the many committees in my various roles I have sat on, has always been one of the most exciting groups. I don't think I ever was bored at any meeting of CREST. It was a really dynamic group right from the start. It was led extremely well by Gary, and it started off, and we initial focus was on areas which, surprise, surprise, maybe wouldn't change too much if you were looking at areas today that you might be interested in clinical efficiency. One of our first pieces of work was looking at waiting list management. We then moved on to outpatient management, and George Humphreys, surgeon from Antrim, and myself, we were asked to develop a set of guidance on outpatient management. What we did, and I think looking in the room, I'm quite sure some of you would have been involved in this, we asked every doctor in Northern Ireland what they felt needed to be done to improve outpatient management. So we surveyed all the GPs and we surveyed all the consultants. One of the questions we asked the consultants was, how did you come to organise your outpatient clinic? And what steps, when you took over as a consultant, did you put in place to organise your clinic? The answer came back loud and clear. They basically all did what happened in the clinic before they arrived. I think George and I felt that given that we estimated you would spend 20,000 hours of your working life and outpatients, it might have been worth spending an hour or two thinking through the process in terms of outpatient management. So really, CREST was about helping doctors really to look at ways of improving their practice. The following year, in 1989, Gary was then involved in the establishment of another group, which was the Northern Ireland Regional Audit Advisory Committee. And again, looking in the room, I'm quite sure there were a number of members of this committee over the years. Gary was the second chair of this committee, and it had a remit really to advise and support on development of audit across Northern Ireland, and to organise audit in particular of smaller specialties. And that committee really worked then over nearly 20 years in promoting audit in Northern Ireland, and its last chair was Tom Trinnock, who subsequently has gone on to be the first chair of GAIN. Not content with that, Gary then moved on, and I believe in a kind of smoke-filled, or probably not smoke-filled, room in Mazarine Hospital in 1993. Gary, Philip, and a number of other people from other disciplines sat down and said, well, we do need to look at how audit could be moved into other specialties. And the outcome of that was the establishment of the Regional Multiprofessional Audit Group. And here's its first conference, September 1995. You might recognise a few familiar faces in that picture. But again, that group went on to actively support audit in other in disciplines as well as medicine right through for the next 14 or 15 years. But Gary's very early death, all of these groups kept going, but we got together in 2005, 2006, and felt it would be possibly a good time to think about bringing the groups together. So this event was held in September 2007, and many of the members of the original groups, who you may again recognise a number of familiar faces throughout the years of the three groups, met at Stormont to celebrate the work, which was very much down to the influence of Gary over the years. We really celebrated the work of the three organisations, but agreed that we would establish this new group called GAIN. And GAIN, I'm glad to say, is carrying on Gary's legacy. Just yesterday was the third annual conference of GAIN, and in fact, in this year alone already, we've published three sets of guidance, one on the management of chronic kidney disease, one on standards for diabetes in care homes, and one on hyponatremia. So the whole work of, that Gary has established is moving forward through GAIN. And here's just some of the guidelines which clinicians will now see coming on towards with charts and so on to support them, really supporting GAIN. So, as I said, it is a great privilege for me, I think, to present this lecture, but I have to say that the work that Gary commenced with the groups that I was involved with is very much still continuing. But tonight, really, I want you to forget you're all sitting here in Belfast in the 2010. And I want you to take you all back to Belfast in 1842. So we're going quite a bit back here. And I want you to really think back and think really what Belfast was like in 1842. In 1842, there was gradually a tourism movement beginning to appear. And people were starting to travel and look at what was happening in other countries. And one of the visitors to Ireland at that time was William Makepeace Thackeray. And I don't know if any of you have aware, but this, I guess, would be one of the first guidebooks to Ireland. It's called the Irish Sketchbook. And this book was really an account of his travels throughout Ireland in 1842. As some of you will know, having maybe read Vanity Fair, he's a great wit, and it's a very amusing book. And it's actually been recently published by a company called Forgotten Books. But having looked at this book, I really think you get a good picture of what Belfast was like in 1842. This is his own caricature of himself on his travels, riding his horse. But he came to Belfast, and his view of Belfast was it was feeling pretty proud of itself. It was looking hearty and thriving, prosperous, as if it had money in its pockets and roast beef for dinner. So Belfast, he said, was really presenting itself really as the capital city of Ireland, even though Dublin was, of course, at the time. And it looked pretty prosperous. However, he was particularly interested in the young ladies of the city, and as you can see, he said he never saw a town where so many women are to be met, so many and so pretty, with or without bonnets, with good figures and neat homely shawls and dresses. So as far as he was concerned, I think Belfast was really looking quite a prosperous place. He went really around the city, and one of his main comments about the city was, we did seem to have a lot of churches. The stranger cannot be failed to be struck or even a bit frightened by the great number of meeting houses that decorate the town. He describes how there was a great deal of sermonising on a Sunday in Belfast. And I don't think he was overly impressed with that, or indeed with the actual structure of the churches. He looked at the academic aspects of the town and was not really that impressed. Of scholars, I saw but a few, and these are mainly in the Drawing Academy. This, of course, is Belfast Ince, one of our, I suppose, most impressive Georgian buildings. In Thackeray's eyes, it was looking a bit dilapidated. It really was looking a bit run down in 1842. He does describe how both the Catholic and Protestant poor of the city were going together to visit to national schools and seemed to be getting on very well, but apparently his view is clearly set out in his sketchbook that at the academy there seemed to be a war going on between the various branches of Presbyterianism in the province, and that this was in fact clearly influencing the academy. But the academy, of course, at that time, Belfast Ince, was where the early medical school was at that stage actually being established. So in terms of academics, not so good. The most impressive, I think, aspect of reading his journey to Belfast, and I think what clearly impressed him the most, was that he was invited, or he got a visit to meet Andrew Mulholland, who ran the York Street Mill. And he describes this incredible establishment. Belfast, as you may be aware, had in the late 1700s become really a cotton town. The charitable institution, at Clifton House. Members of that institution had gone over to see if there was some form of industry that could be brought into the poor house at Clifton House that would actually act as a source of employment for those who were in the poor house. And they really came back and introduced the cotton industry there in Clifton House with bringing over two looms. Cotton in the early part of the 1800s then boomed, and Belfast was becoming really a cotton town. It still had some linen, but it was really being established as a cotton town. But what happened was the cotton industry went into decline in the 1820s, and a large fire happened at the mill in York Street, which was owned by the Mulholland family, and they decided to rebuild the factory as a linen mill. And that, on the basis of that decision, Belfast became what was known as a linenopolis, really, I guess. Really, it was across Europe, known for its linen industry. But this huge establishment was then in operation in York Street, and what Thackeray describes is the incredible power of the machinery in this facility, but that all this power was being generated to effectively create thread, which was taking several strands that together were all smaller than a human hair. And he describes really how the immense power was being used within the steam industry to actually generate this facility. However, being Thackeray, he also was very impressed with the 500 young ladies who worked in the facility. But that really, by that stage, was Belfast was beginning to boom in terms of a city that had a strong industrial base. So in terms of then Thackeray's visit, Belfast was looking pretty good. But he didn't say much about the healthcare system, and the doctors of 1842, I think, would probably have felt quite proud of themselves as well as to what the systems were working in the city. We had our General Hospital in Frederick Street. The General Hospital had opened in 1817, and by this time it was a well-established General Hospital. Today, I'm afraid to say, it's a car park. This is all. It's just there's still a Frederick Street car park. You can't really see that at the bottom here, but that's all that's left is that actually to remind us that was where the General Hospital was. Of course, it moved up at the end of the century to become the Royal Victoria Hospital. Just on this site, we of course had the workhouse. The workhouse, again, the city would have been proud of. It was opened in the year before, in 1841, for 1,000 paupers. Some people in the room, including myself, worked in this very building, which of course then was demolished at the time when the tower block opened. The workhouse was one of a whole programme of workhouses across Ireland. I'm afraid today it has also been superseded by the car park here at the bottom on the way into the tower block. So the two main institutions of the town, I guess, at that stage, there's no real recollection anything there to remind us. In terms of mental health, and I know there's a number of people in the audience who come from mental health background, at this stage we had a very thriving asylum that was on the site where now the Sick Children's Hospital is. It had been opened in 1828. It was, I think, from reading some of the history of it, it was really quite an advanced facility. They really aimed as far as possible not to use restraining of the patients who were in the facility. And once again, we have no, I think, facility left there really to see where that building once stood. So, but what I'm really trying to say is that the doctors of the town, I think, at that stage, just as the rest, I think, of those who were running the factories and so on, would probably have felt that Belfast was thriving in 1842. But if you scratched below the surface, things were not quite so promising. This really is a list of some of the problems that were beginning to emerge of this growing city. We're still a town at that stage, but the population had grown from 20,000 in 1801 and was now 70,000 early 1840s. That was a huge expansion based primarily on the movement of people in to work in the new industries. The water supply for the town was really in no way really sufficient to support the population in the town. The water supply had previously been under the control of Clifton House in the Belfast Charitable Society, and they ran the water supply up until 1840. It then moved into the care of the water commissioners. But although there was an organised water supply that came down from Stranmillis through quite an ingenious set of pipes and culverts down to some fountains in the town, such as in Fountain Street, it really was not designed for a town of 70,000 people. Sewage disposal for many of the population, probably about half the population, was nil. There really was no organised system for sewage disposal other than for some of the larger houses in the town. The Victorians tended to count everything, as if you look back at those of those in the room who are interested in history. They did a survey of the number of dung heaps across the city, and the leading street was Donegal Street, which some of you know starts with a bank and ends in the poor house. But it's just along that street they had 341 dunghills just along that one street. So really sewage disposal was very much in its infancy. Housing really was very poor. There are many accounts in newspapers, in books at the time, and really where people were crowded into very poor built accommodation, limited ventilation, sometimes no actually furniture within the house, living in straw, maybe two or three families living to a room. Washing facilities, again, probably with the scarcity of water, where you've had to carry the water from the fountain, again, very limited. And one of the particular problems of the city was the cemeteries. There were three cemeteries, including the one over in Stranmillis Road at Friars Bush. There was one that was owned by Clifton House. And then there was another one on towards the Shankill Road. But they really had not the capacity for the number of deaths that were occurring in the town. And in previous major epidemics, two of the cemeteries had to open up mass graves whenever the cholera epidemic had occurred, for example, in 1832. The census of 1841 had reported that the average age of death in the town was 9. So that's not possibly quite in the same measure as a life expectancy, but it gives an indication of what the health of the population were. More than half of the population were under the age of 20. Certainly for parts of the town, the infant death rate would have been in excess of 200. So really the actual life expectancy was poor, and this was a town that was considering itself to be, extremely really beginning to develop well. The town had already established a history of quite large epidemics over a number of years. The 1832 cholera epidemic had a major impact in the town, with some 500 deaths out of a population of 50,000. There had been a large epidemic of fever in 1836, and in 1837 there was what was described as an epidemic of influenza. Each of those had significant mortality. And so the town was getting used to the cycle of epidemics. As far as I'm aware, there was not a lot of indication that people were aware of industrial disease, but certainly as the factories were developing, that undoubtedly would have been adding to the problems in the town, with respiratory disease in particular, with the mill industry. So clearly there was a significant body of opinion at the time that while the town was well, that now things were beginning to emerge that in fact there was a significant set of health problems in this town. From a public health perspective, clearly my view is that at this stage some public health action was urgently required. And these two doctors came to the town in 1842, and they played a major role in public health in the town, really, over the next 60 years, in the case of, 40 years in the case of Samuel Brown. Each of them, I think, will have been mentioned before in talks at the Ulster Medical Society, but as I said, I'm not going to talk about their clinical work, which was very substantial this evening. On the left, you have Dr. Andrew Malcolm. Andrew was the son of a Presbyterian minister. His father was a well-known minister who had been the moderator of the General Assembly. He was another Andrew Malcolm, and he was from Newry. And Andrew, I think looking back, was one of the brightest doctors of his day. He had trained in Edinburgh. He had won one of the three gold medals in Edinburgh for a treatise on fever. He personally had had a fever the previous year in 1841 when he was, I guess, on an elective, if that was what they called in those days, at the General Hospital in Belfast. But he came back to the town in 1842. His father had died at a young age of 37 from typhus fever in Newry, and his mother had brought Andrew and his brothers to Belfast. But he came back and right from the start really had a clear commitment to improving the health of the population in Belfast. He was a very strong opponent of alcohol, and perhaps that maybe is interesting because our second person on the screen is Dr. Samuel Brown. Dr. Samuel Brown, RN, Royal Navy, as he's often known. And Dr. Brown had come from a slightly different route to Belfast. Again, I think he will have been talked about before. His father was also a Presbyterian minister from Castle Dawson, and he was a member of a well-known Presbyterian family. He had trained in Dublin. In Dublin, he got interested in surgery, but he decided to join the Navy and went to really as a surgeon's mate. He had trained to be a surgeon's mate, and from the period about 1828 up to 1840, he had really what appears to be an impeccable record in the Navy. He gradually, by 1839, became really through the ranks and became a surgeon, a ship's surgeon. And he was at that stage in Plymouth on the guardship. Something happened then, clearly, because he was sent to the West Indies. And in the West Indies, in 1841, he was court-martialed for drunkenness. It's not absolutely clear what happened there. I think the people I've read about say clearly it wasn't totally out of character, and it wasn't. But whatever happened, the Navy decided that his name would be moved right back down to the bottom of the list of surgeons, which effectively meant he would have to work his whole way up again. So what seems to have happened then, he came back to Belfast in 1842. We see him living in Arthur Street on leave. He still remained in the Navy for quite a number of years, but he increasingly became an important figure within the medical establishment as a leading surgeon in Belfast. But again, he went on, and we'll talk a wee bit more about his career in public health over the period. But these two became, I think, by the looks of it, very close friends and colleagues. By 1846, Samuel Brown had opened one of the first eye and ear facilities in Mill Street in the town, and Andrew, he was in the same facility, was running probably the first children's clinic in the town. So throughout the period that we can see, they did work very collaboratively on a number of public health issues. What was happening in Belfast, of course, wasn't alone in this. In 1842, Sir Edwin Chadwick published, at his own expense, a very important report on the sanitary conditions of the labouring population in Great Britain. And this really has brought, I suppose, to the attention of the public in England and Scotland and Wales, the filthy conditions really that people were living in, and the actual impact on health. And Chadwick's report led to a Royal Commission. This is a subsequent report he produced on the practice of internment in the really burials in cities and towns the following year. But from this start, there was beginning to be a clear drive towards improving sanitation, and the sanitary movement of public health was beginning to emerge. In Belfast, Andrew Mulholland, who I mentioned before, had really ran the mill in York Street. He became mayor in 1845, and in early 1845, in his inaugural speech as mayor, he set out on a campaign to improve the health of the population of Belfast through measures such as improving public parks, baths, improving education. But at this stage, money was very tight, and Andrew Malcolm became a fundamentally important figure in the improvement of health in Belfast. The first initiative that Andrew appears to have got involved with was a society called the Society for the Amelioration of the Condition of the Working Classes. A group of people from the town came together in early 1845 and really to look at how they could take forward Andrew Mulholland's vision for a healthier Belfast. They decided, having looked at what might be practical, this is not the clearest picture, but they felt that that what would be an important initial step was to develop a facility that would allow people to wash their clothes and also have baths in Belfast. And this building really was Belfast, in fact Ireland's, first public bath and wash house. What happened was that Andrew was, first of all, he was appointed as the secretary to this group. He got £50 a year for that role. And he was immediately the next month off to England looking at really towns and cities where there were public baths and washhouses. He came back with a report. The committee agreed. This was all in the main money that was raised on a voluntary basis. And they commissioned Sir Charles Lanyon to actually design the first public bath. They then ran into what certainly, as far as I'm aware, was Belfast's first case of NIMBYism. They decided, they got a site that looked quite promising in College Street. The local citizens there decided perhaps it wasn't the place maybe for a public bath. And then they actually bought some site round in College Square. At that site then they ran into the establishment who lived in their flash houses, or the important houses around, who decided they really, if they were going to have a facility for the poor, it certainly wasn't going to be around College Square. So they had to move and then found a site up at Peter's Hill, near what's now Townsend Street. But with the design of Charles Lanyon, with the report that Andrew had brought back from England, within 2 years, this very impressive facility opened up at Peter's Hill. And this was really a major advance for the population in the city. Here, if you might just be able to see this. This was the interior of the washroom. And here's where you brought your clothes. If you wanted a bath, it cost a penny if you wanted a cold bath, 2p if you want, 2 old pennies if you wanted a warm bath, and if you wanted the vapours, they cost 4p, and if you wanted a private bath upstairs, it cost a shilling. So clearly there was a kind of variety. From the day it opened in May 1847, within 9 days, there had been 1,300 people at bath, so probably their first ever bath happened, really. And this facility became a major facility for the population of the town. Unfortunately, this is really the ironing room, so obviously a very impressive facility, but right from the start it ran into financial problems. Andrew had set out with the belief that this would be a facility that the town council would invest money in, but really for the next 15 years, in spite of many attempts, money, really official funding, never materialised, and by 1860 the facility had to close. The water commissioners were suing it for not paying their water bills. Charles Lanyon wrote a letter sort of gently suggesting he'd never been paid for his services, but on learning about the financial position agreed to actually waive his costs. But in fact by 1860 the facility was closed, and it was a further nearly 30 years before the official town bathhouses. But from the point of view of actually getting a facility into place in short space of time, I think we have to give Andrew Malcolm incredible credit. He went on then the following year to focus on his other main area, which he felt was needed to improve the health of the population, which was through education. And this was another society that was set up later in the year, the Belfast Working Classes Association for the Promotion of General Improvement, quite a title. And this society, really, again, with the support of the mill owners, was seen as really an important vehicle that would move to improve the educational standards for the whole population within the city. Its first initiative was to set up a people's newsroom. Everything that the society did was the people's. something or other. The People's Newsroom was set up in 1846. It was down just off Rosemary Street. It brought in about 95 journals from as far away as Canada and America, and the daily newspapers, and for a penny you could go in and look at, read these papers, or you could pay a shilling. A shilling would have brought you a 3 month membership of this facility. It became extremely popular. A second one was opened just down the road from here, what was called the Malone Turnpike, which is just in Shaftesbury Square. Then another one over in Ballinafay, just across the bridge. And this really would have been a major opportunity for people who had not previously had access to the news to learn really what was happening. The second initiative was to set up a circulating library. Circulating library simply meant you brought your books back, but the People's Circulating Library wasn't quite as successful as the newsroom, but by the 1850 had 3,000 books, both novels and many other books, and again for something like, I think, one and sixpence. I'm talking old money for those of you who don't, but what would that be? 15 pence. For 15 pence you could be a 3 month member of the Circulating Library. Or if you actually joined the two up, I think you could get 2 shillings per member of both. The next initiative was a People's Magazine, and this was really to let people know what was happening in the city, the kind of health of Belfast magazine, I suppose, of its day. This is the first edition, and it thunders against the sanitary conditions in the city. But this was a magazine that really preached things like walks, about fresh air, about ventilation, about baths. And I've read some of the copies of this within the Lindenhall Library, and it's a fascinating account really of Belfast at that time. The next initiative was, as there was no X Factor in those days to amuse you on a Saturday evening, was to set up a set of Saturday night lectures. So right through the winter period, for a number of years, in the theatre or in the assembly rooms, depending on, I think, what was available, there was a lecture. Now, these were not an amusing evening out. These were serious lectures. Samuel Brown, for example, gave a lecture on the anatomy of the eye. They had lectures on physiology given by Henry Cook, one of the ministers of the town who had trained earlier to be a doctor. They had lectures on sanitation. They had people come over from England to give lectures. And these were absolutely packed out. So this was clearly meeting a need. The society did want to promote a college of design, but this proved beyond their means as a voluntary organisation. But subsequently, in 1849, when the Queen's moved from the academy up to the new building, it created some space, and the council then did support a College of Design. So by 1846, things were again looking pretty good here. There was a lot of work going on in the city in terms of improving the health. But what none of the doctors at that point realised was that Belfast was just about to face probably three of the most difficult years ever in the history of health care and social care in Belfast. A series of three challenges really hit the city over 3 years. The first was in 1846 was the impact of the famine. And the famine in September, in the summer of 1845, reports emerged really of potato blight across Europe. It affected some 40% of the crop. And in 1846, the crop failed. And although sometimes there's a view that Belfast didn't really suffer too significantly in the famine, this has been, I think, very successfully challenged in a book recently, which looks at the impact of the famine in Belfast called The Hidden Famine by Christine Keneally and Gerard McAtasey. And this really sets out just to the extent that the famine impact in Belfast. And here's Andrew Malcolm's quote from the time: "We well remember the aspects of the hordes of the poor who thronged into the town from all parts. Famine was depicted in the look, in the hue, in the voice and the gait." People came to Belfast for a number of reasons. First of all, clearly it was a possible place you would find food. It was also a possible place you might find some employment, but also ships did leave Belfast for Canada, and therefore people came here looking to emigrate to Canada. But this had a significant impact on the town. In social care at that stage, it became a voluntary action, a set of actions to really improve the health of the population. A relief committee was established, large soup kitchens were set up. There was a building called the House of Correction in Howard Street, the old House of Correction, and it became the centre of one of the main soup kitchens. And by March 1847, 15,000 people were surviving in the town based on soup kitchens. Bedding and clothing was being distributed by groups such as the Belfast Ladies Clothing Committee, and a day asylum was opened up really for somewhere for people to go. So there was a big voluntary effort, but this certainly was beginning to have a significant impact on the town. The doctors in the town knew from previous experience in 1816 that after famine it was likely there would be some fever. And the next major challenge to hit the city was the following year in March 1847. Fever was beginning to happen, was starting to spread within the city, but I don't know if anyone's aware of this event, but at the time it was a very significant event, which was the arrival of a ship called the Swatara. And this is a rather sad notice from the Times of the 22nd of March 1847. What happened was the Swatara was an emigrant ship from Liverpool. And this is the report in the Times that says that the ship left Liverpool, it ran into a large storm, it ran into serious difficulties in the seas off the Isle of Man, lost its masts, lost one of the masts, several of the emigrants were dead, and it put it into Belfast. It then moved from Belfast up to having been refitted to go to Derry, but it ran once again into a storm when it left Derry, and was forced back to Belfast, really having lost its mast for the third time, and came back to Belfast. But at this stage it was clear that there were people on the ship that had a fever. The ship docked in Belfast. Initially the people were managed on the ship, but then some of them were brought over into the fever hospital, the general hospital, and a deputation of doctors went on board to find the conditions were horrendous, really. There was extremely poor ventilation on the ship, it was overcrowded, the food supplies were basically some bread for this group, and there were people who were dying on the ship. Over the next number of months, and extremely well documented, this is the set of admissions to the fever hospitals in Belfast over the next by month over the next year. What this shows really is after the Swatara arrived, there was a major outbreak occurred. Fever began to spread, with up to by July 600 people admitted to hospitals with fever. The type of fever is not absolutely clear. Doctors at the time broke it down and felt there was at least four different types of fever. It was probably a combination of typhus, possibly typhoid, and what was described as a relapsing fever. But in effect, this completely overwhelmed the emerging healthcare system in the city. Here's a report at the time one of many reports where we have here, we're looking down High Street. Of course, the Albert Clock wasn't there at that stage, but a mother with an emaciated child slumped under a shop window on the south side of the street. Child died in her arms 5 minutes later. Her son had died in similar circumstances 3 weeks previously. And this is just one of many reports of people actually dying in the streets in the centre of Belfast at the time. What happened? Well, basically, the facilities that the hospitals did seek to actually try to cope with this by setting up a series of emergency measures. Here's the Reverend William Johnson, who was a well-known Presbyterian minister at the time, and he described the circumstances during the outbreak. He's saying that, "Oh, Mr. Johnson, it's dreadful to have fever and be lying three to bed," in which case he says he lifted one of the men and put them into another bed. At that time, what the arrangement was, in an emergency situation, a town could ask the government to set up a Board of Health, which was really an emergency planning committee. It's a bit of a swine flu feeling about this period at the time. But on this site, a major move was to actually set up a tented hospital. So just really where we are now, there would have been running down towards the Lisburn Road a number of large tents set up, and 700 people were treated in tents at the workhouse. The workhouse itself, of course, was packed. At the general hospital, a shed was developed to be a hospital. There was a temporary hospital in an old building at the college. But it's estimated that over the period of this outbreak, 13,000 people were affected out of the population of some 70,000, and over 1,700 people died. This, of course, put enormous pressure onto the cemeteries, onto the healthcare facilities. And in fact, as far as I'm aware, this is the first recorded time in Ireland where there was actually a decision in the hospital to suspend elective surgery to deal with an outbreak. A situation, of course, that many of us came to know again many times in the future. But over this period, I think you can see in reading the history of it that the doctors played a massive role really in looking at how the systems could be developed for the population. They then probably breathed a sigh of relief when the fever removed. But the next year, Andrew Malcolm became aware that a dreadful calamity is impending, and the third challenge began to emerge. It's quite remarkable now, looking back, just how well informed the doctors of the time were. Andrew Malcolm realised in early 1848, from his contacts and from reading, I guess, the literature of the time, that cholera was on its way from Asia by five different routes towards Belfast, and that this is an early map, really, of the spread, how cholera spread. You'll not see that too clearly. But there's been a number of waves of cholera, but they could see that cholera was coming. Now, while the fever had been really a very difficult period for them, their memories of the cholera epidemic of 1832 meant that this was the real disease that they feared at the time. Andrew took no time at all to get things together to actually start the process. He set up a town meeting. He called a town meeting in 1848. He prepared his own report on the sanitary conditions of the city. And a committee was drawn up with a diverse range of members, leading clergy and doctors. By 1848, they had a cholera notice. This really was their emergency plan. They set up a cholera station. This was probably our first out of hours GP centre. A doctor was at all times at the House of Correction with a horse ready to ride to the first house that the cholera was discovered in. They appointed what they actually called health visitors, who went to every house in the town and gave advice about making sure you had your house whitewashed, that you were ready and what to do if the cholera arrived. The city was divided, or the town really, into two quarters. The workhouse looked after one half of the town, the general hospitals to look after the other, and the poor house went into quarantine, where you only were allowed out by mean march to church and back again, but with no contact with anyone. But that was the only way you were allowed out. So they really had a set of measures in place. Of course, Andy was right, and cholera arrived. The first case was reported in the asylum and doesn't appear to have led to any major contact. But then a man called Thomas Tiernan was removed from the workhouse in Edinburgh and came here to the workhouse on this site, and he and his family had cholera, and soon cholera was spreading very rapidly on the site in the workhouse. This is the map of the cholera epidemic of the time, and you can see there was a major peak in March 1849, and the second peak was on the 23rd of July. And again, they had superb systems of statistics and collecting information, and this shows the different districts of the town. Samuel Brown was responsible for the College District, and Andrew Malcolm for the Hospital District, and they were measuring on a weekly basis how this disease was spreading through the town. Andrew Malcolm believed that the measures they took were successful, even though there were 2,700 cases and some 900 of those died. The actual mortality rate appeared to be less in Belfast than in other cities in Ireland. But I've particularly emphasised the date, the 23rd of July 1849, because at that stage a second type of fever was beginning to impact on the population, and this was a fever of excitement, because just at that time the Queen Green, it was announced, was going to have a visit to Ireland, and that Belfast was going to be part of the visit. So actually the Queen, Victoria, came to Belfast just after the peak on the 11th of August of the peak of this cholera epidemic. So clearly that wasn't keeping her back. Here she is in the City Hall, and I think it's interesting to look back and think just how much of Belfast was impacted by the Queen's visit. She arrived really in a gale. She had left the ship, left Dublin the day before, and I think the conditions probably were pretty horrendous as they sailed up. And in fact, I'm sure the time they came to Belfast, they weren't necessarily really ready for the massive, really, excitement that Belfast was ready to deliver when they got off the ship. She was in Belfast for, a grand total of 4 hours. She got off the ship. She came in. They opened the Victoria Channel, which is as she came up. She passed Queen's Island, where most of the population were looking at her. She then officially opened, the Queen's Bridge. She went past where we now have the Albert Clock, with Albert coming with her. She passed Victoria Street, came up through the centre of the town. She now came past here where the White Linhall was, and here she has her statue. She visited up Queen's University, or Queen's College, went back down what's Great Victoria Street, and then eventually back in the ship. So within 4 hours, she'd basically named half the streets of Belfast as we know them. And of course, we now have the Victoria Centre where on Victoria Street. So this was clearly a major event for the doctors in the town, and particularly Andrew Malcolm, whose father, in fact, had met George IV when he came to visit Ireland, in the only other time in the 1800s that a monarch visited Belfast. And for the next 2 or 3 years, there was a fete for the Victoria Day fete that Andrew was and his sister were particularly involved in organising on Queen's Island. Queen's Island became a centre where there was a park. We had our own Crystal Palace, such as like the Crystal Palace in London on Queen's Island. And Andrew's famous history of the first history of the General Hospital was written to be sold on Victoria Day as to raise money for the Royal for the Royal Victoria Hospital. Queen Victoria, whatever message she got that day, clearly felt things weren't going too well in the funding at the Royal, General Hospital, and a personal cheque on her name was of £300 was sent to keep the hospital going in Belfast. After Queen Victoria's visit, things began to improve in the city. And Andrew Malcolm, he lived at the corner here of York Street and Donegal Street, just close to where the College of Design. I'm sure he now would be delighted to know that his house is very close to the College of Design, which was one of the things areas that he was interested in. He moved his attention to focus on the health of people working in the factories of Belfast. And one of his major pieces of work was to carry out his own study, in which it appears he examined some 2,000 workers in the linen industry. And he was able to show which rooms in the factory had the greatest instance of respiratory disease. He presented this at in Glasgow in 1855. And he showed that really 18.75% of people who worked in the linen industry, of women, had chest disease compared to 6%, and he came up with a set of important recommendations for improving the health of women in the linen industry: regulation of windows, ventilating panes, wearing respirators, and so on. Tragically, the following year, he himself died at the young age of 37. He probably had achieved more in his lifetime than many of the public health or clinical doctors, I think, that any of us can recall, and yet this was done with an enormous energy, I think, over a short period of time. On the other hand, Samuel Brown went on to live in a grand four-storey Georgian house, which I'm sure he might be quite surprised to know is now just on the site where the biggest bank robbery of its time took place at the Northern Bank here in Donegal Square. He became the mayor of the city in 1870, and at the age of 71 became the first medical officer of health for the city. He had previously been the sanitary officer, the chief sanitary officer. In clinical terms, he had a very significant role in Belfast. He was, I guess, very much responsible for developing the first big eye hospital in Shaftesbury Square. And with his son, they were, the first eye surgeons for Belfast. He also, the picture on the right, I don't know if anybody knows what that is, but that is the first children's hospital in the city in Queen Street, which is, as I say, looking rather sad in the middle of a building site. It was again a state-of-the-art facility that was opened in 1873, and Samuel Brown was one of the main people who were arguing for developing that facility. It then became the Queen Street Police Station in its later years, and it's now to be a theme pub, but at this point I'm not sure whether the theme is a children's hospital or a police pub, but we'll no doubt wait to see. But where Samuel Brown, really carried on much of his public health work was in this building, which is the Town Hall of Belfast, the original Town Hall of Belfast, which is still standing in Town Hall Street. In the Town Hall, a number of important acts in public health were really developed over the period. So with acts that relate to housing, street lighting, sewage, water supplies were moved, and really towards the latter part of the century, the infrastructure that really underpinned the development of the city was put in place by the Victorians. But let's go back to today. If William Thackeray came back today, what sort of Belfast would he see now? Well, the most recent, I think, guide we have to Belfast is the Lonely Planet Guide. And here's what the Lonely Planet Guide was saying just a couple of years ago at Belfast. So Belfast has been transformed from a bombs and bullets pariah to a cosmopolitan city. It's now a hip city. We've got hip hotels and hedonism. It's really a place to come. In fact, the guide, the latest version of the Lonely Planet Guide says, get here fast because it's going to be packed out with people for the Titanic Memorial in 1812. So once again, Belfast is looking like a city that's been reported as a city that's going to thrive. Here we have an image really looking over our Victoria Centre, and you can see that where the old town hall was is now really, really surrounded by new buildings, new facilities, the Victoria Centre across the street. So Belfast is looking pretty prosperous in terms of its revival over the last few years. Of course, that's nothing compared to what's going to be like in 2 or 3 years' time. Here we have the model of the Titanic Quarter, the Titanic Quarter being on Queen's Island, where once again, after 150 years, it's going to be a centre for with parks, with a leisure, where people will throng, I guess, to the new Titanic building, just as they thronged to the palace that was built there in 1851. So again, if looking at Belfast and looking at the guidebooks, it's now a city that really, if the Victorians come back, they would think they've done pretty well. Unfortunately, I think if it was Andrew Malcolm and Samuel Brown, I don't think that's what they would think at all. This is a graph showing the life expectancy by every local authority in the United Kingdom. This is published every year. This is the most recent one for 2006 to 2008 for men. Belfast is here. We have the fifth lowest life expectancy of any local authority in the United Kingdom. It's only in some parts of Glasgow and really out in the areas of inner city Glasgow and the area of around Strathclyde that's got a worse life expectancy than Belfast. If we look at women, you're slightly better if you're a woman, but we're still the 23rd lowest out of local authorities. Recently, an organisation who's done a lot to really promote health in Belfast over the last 20 years, called Belfast Healthy Cities. Belfast Healthy Cities has really been looking at what is the health pattern within Belfast, and they produced a report called Divided by Health. For a long time, we've known about how Belfast has been divided into different sections, but this report is actually looking at the health divide within Belfast. And it's a profile, really, of a number of health indicators of Belfast. The next four diagrams are going to see, if you're sitting in the back, will all look exactly the same, and that's exactly because they are exactly the same. But this one is the health deprivation indices for Belfast, the wards in Belfast. And you can see there's a large red area and a green area. And basically Belfast is split down the middle into an area of very significant deprivation, where the red area is you are in the top, if you like, quarter or quintile of deprivation, and the green area you're in the bottom. If we look at wards where there's at least one person living with limiting long-term illness, once again, if you're in the deprived area, you're in the top quintile of people with long-term illness. If you're in the green area, you're in the best quintile. This is the education achievement, which Andrew Malcolm would have been so excited really about looking at how that had maybe been achieved. Once again, we see significant areas of Belfast where the proportion of school leavers who achieve less than 5 GCSEs is very high. This is of particular importance in children who've been in care, and there's recently been a report which has shown that actually the educational achievement of people who've been through the care system in Northern Ireland is extremely poor. Whether you're in the foster care is better than if you're in a children's home, but certainly if you were in a children's home, your chance of receiving any significant number of GCSEs is very unlikely. And looking at mortality, the mortality of all of Belfast, as I showed on the graph, is we're in the very lowest of the areas in the UK, but within Belfast, that splits into two areas. So if you're in North and West Belfast, your mortality rate is very poor compared to the rest of the UK. This means that you're up to wards that have a standardised mortality ratio, which Maureen, I'm sure, will keep, but is looking like it's twice your chances of being in some of the red areas. You have up to nearly 3 to 4 times your mortality rate of some of the green areas. So they're very significant differences in Belfast. Just about 8 weeks ago, we were saddened to learn of the death of another of the 20th century's great public health doctors, Sir Donald Acheson. Sir Donald, as you will be aware, was from Belfast. He did retain an interest in what was happening in Belfast throughout his life, in his working life. He became the chief medical officer in England, where he's particularly recognised for his work with HIV. And may well, though I'm not clear about have actually addressed this society in the past. He's particularly in public health remembered for his raising awareness of health inequalities, and he produced a similar report in 1998, his Acheson Report on Inequalities. In 2003, he came to launch the first anniversary of this document, which some of you will be aware of, called Investing for Health. I think from a public health perspective, we see this as, if you like, the greatest achievement of the first period that we had in Assembly, because this was a cross-government set of initiatives to improve health. So all the government departments were involved in signing up, whether it was in transport or education, in housing, to actually improving health in Belfast in this strategy called Investing for Health. And Sir Donald, at his talk, said that this was the most comprehensive analysis and framework for action on the wider determinants of health in the world. So he really believed we had a strategy to improve health for Belfast, and this strategy is currently being updated again. So we have a good strategy. What can we learn from the Victorian doctors about improving health in 21st century Belfast? I think what they can teach is about implementation. We can have a very good strategy, but unless it's actually implemented, it's not going to actually do very much. What the doctors in Victorian times clearly did is they got out and acted. They did things. And they were very proactive. They saw a problem and they got on with it and doing something about it. They worked very much in partnership. You can see that they worked really with the clergy, they worked with politicians, they worked with people in education, they worked with architects, and really they took as many people as possible along with them on the journey to improve health. Looking at what they managed to achieve in the time they did, they must have been extremely persuasive. They actually raised money very quickly for initiatives. They could persuade politicians, not always successfully in terms of like what happened to the baths, but they were able to use their influence in the city. But they did persevere. If we look at Samuel Brown, he retained this interest in public health from his early interest in sanitation in the 1840s. He was still working in 1888 when he was well in his 80s, and he was still writing his reports on public health up to his 80s. He, right throughout his life, saw the need to improve. His last public health report focused on respiratory disease in Belfast. And I think he would be delighted to know that one of the initiatives, which I'm almost certain he would have been at the opening of this building in 1888, which is the baths, the new baths, then in Ormo Avenue, that he died 2 years later but was active in 1888, this was really the culmination of an initiative over a long period. And I'm sure this is now where the chief executive of the new public health agency has their office, and I'm sure he'd be delighted to see that it's still operating as a public health facility. But also, looking to some of the problems we've had recently in terms of swine flu and looking at dealing with emergencies, the Victorian doctors clearly did focus on preparation and planning. They put effort in to actually prepare for things happening. And we now have an organisation in the city called Belfast Resilience, which brings together the emergency services of the city. But they had their Belfast Sanitary Committee, which was operating just, I guess, in many ways as effectively to act across the sectors of the city. So where are we now? Well, basically, if Queen Victoria was to come back to Belfast and sail up, she would quite recognise the Queen's Bridge, probably, which she opened in 1849. She probably wouldn't necessarily recognise this lady, the Ring of Thanksgiving, our statue that we now have at the end of the Queen's Bridge on Thanksgiving Square. She's better maybe affectionately known as Nulla with a Hula, or the doll and the ball, depending on which view, but Nulla with a Hula is really an indication of thanksgiving. I think Belfast has a lot to thank these Victorian doctors for. Indeed, the Ulster Medical Society itself, Andrew Malcolm was instrumental in setting up one of the two groups, the Belfast Clinical Pathological Society, which came together to form the Ulster Medical Society in, as it says in the poster, 1862. He also was an active member of the Belfast Medical Society, the other society, and I think was instrumental in getting the library of the society up and running. There's a lot we can be thankful for, but they're not really all that remembered. So my final word is I think we do need to do something to get our two, at least these two and some of the other leading medical people, remembered in the city. And perhaps a blue plaque for each of them wouldn't go amiss. I think some action to actually put them on the map. So with that, I will finish my talk. Thank you very much for listening, and hopefully that's given you a wee bit of an idea as to what some of our predecessors as members of this organisation were doing some 150 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. That was excellent and very interesting. I'm sure there'll be questions for you. Who'd like to start? Yes, Bob.
David, that was very interesting. One of the striking things to me was the fact that the Victorian doctors combined clinical practice with public health, and that doesn't happen nowadays. When did the two of them separate, and do you think that was a good thing?
At the time, I think public health wasn't organised, and I think that they were primarily clinicians but had an interest in public health. By the end of the 1800s, there were doctors who were medical officers of health who were moving away from clinical practice. But certainly into the 20th century, there were still doctors who did carry out some clinical practice and some public health practice. Do I think that's a good thing? To be honest, looking back, I think no. I think it would be good if some doctors did retain a clinical interest as well as a public health interest. And that there are a few doctors in the UK who still retain a clinical interest. Public health has now moved to become a multidisciplinary profession, and there are clearly doctors in as directors of public health, but there are clinicians or from other disciplines and non-clinicians in public health. But I think looking back, you can see the value of having people who actually had both an interest in clinical practice and in public health practice. So I think if I get the tenor of your question, I think I could see the benefits of actually some doctors retaining an interest in clinical practice, although of course now with as specialties emerge, it's become increasingly difficult, I guess, to do that.
Can I? Did the great mill owners take much interest in the health of their workers, and did they do much?
Well, Holland was very interested in the health of his workers, and I think that he was both in the health of his workers and in the health of the population in the city. And I think, looking back, I think perhaps the mill owners have got a bad press, because they were actively interested in actions that would improve their own employees' health, I guess partly from the interest that that would be of benefit to themselves as employers. But they did look at ways of reducing accidents in the mills. They certainly did look at ways of improving the, I think, things like the ventilation in the mill. But I wouldn't say they were totally there was a certain degree of self-interest, I guess, in it. But Mulholland certainly emerged as reading at the time as someone who took a strong view that, about improving education, about having education facilities for his own staff. Maybe I've given it too good a press, but at the time, of course, the mill was a place where children as young as 8 and 9 were working. I know my own grandmother. She was came from a family, and she, at the age of 8 or 9, she was what's called a half and halfer, where you were spent half your time working in the mill and half the time at school. So this was, it was a location where the number of health problems must have been horrendous. If you look at some of the descriptions of the time of the amount of dust in the mill, of the potential for accidents and putting your hand into machinery, but I think maybe that the mill owners themselves, certainly they supported Andrew Malcolm, and he applied to become at one point the chief kind of factories inspector for the city, if I can't remember that exact term, and he was supported by the mill owners in that role.
Morning.
David, in the time that you were talking about when Malcolm was active, there's very little in the way of active treatment for anything in terms of the management of disease. So in fact, there may have been a greater audience for listening to what doctors said was possible in terms of sanitation and that sort of thing. I think probably part of the division has come about because of the absorption into all the things that can be done therapeutically. It's just not possible to manage the clinical and the public health, I think, to the degree that it would have been then. And I think also the audience for public health out there has been reduced by the belief in the therapeutic, the availability of effective therapy. So there's much more of a clash, I think, than there would have been, hundreds of years ago.
Yes, very interesting.
Yeah.
I think that Dr. Crummy had a question, did it? No? Was there another question down here? No? Yes, sorry.
I was just going to follow up on David's Mulholland and another family, the Charters, who both paid for extensions to the General Hospital in around 1850.
Thank you.
And I mean, these were patients, actually. In fact, actually, the Charters were very much involved also in education, because I know some of our church schools were actually funded by the Charters family. There's also another little interesting bit about the Charters family, who were also large mill owners, is that Henry McCormick eloped with one of the daughters of the Charters, and actually they were all reconciled, and that's actually how the funding of that extension came about, because they all were happy and scaled up into the sunset.
I would just like to support the speaker in his suggestion that we should have a statues or something more than a blue plaque. The historical people here are obviously all members of the people who put up the blue plaques, which is something called the Ulster Historical Foundation. And it would be right and proper that there should be a blue plaque in Andrew Malcolm's place of work and in Samuel Brown's, but as you say, neither of them exist. What we get are these curious statues like Nula with Hula. Could we maybe, from the Ulster Medical Society and the Ulster Historical Society, whatever it is, send a note to the City Hall and saying, we've had this lecture and we think it is important that there should be a statue. As you know, there has been one statue which is in Lisburn to Frank Pantridge. Maybe the time has come.
Well, thank you for that suggestion, yeah. And we'll certainly bring it to the council meeting, and perhaps the Historical Society could write to the Ulster Medical Society to take that forward. Thanks very much, David. John Logan had a question. I think that'll have to be our last question. Time.
Well, there's more common, just to say that Charters, of course, was very kind in the Ulster Medical Society in that he provided us with accommodation, exclusive accommodation, in the General Hospital, when it was, I think, in the new wing that was being rebuilt. So we actually remember Charters.
Anybody else with a really burning question? I don't want to stop an interesting discussion. On the other hand, we have to be mindful of time. Well, if not, thank you very much indeed, David. That's been a really fascinating lecture on post-society. If I can just mention another couple of things as we finish off. The annual golf competition, and I've learned something tonight from Dr. Crummie at the back. It's at the back, very fine trophy. Do you want to hold it up as if you just won the European Cup? And it's called the Victory Cup because who presented it, Martin? The victory in the Second World War. Do you know who presented it? Anyway, it's a plug for Thursday the 13th of May at 2 p.m. I hope, David, when you came in, you didn't think it was for you. It was a very good lecture, but there's no cup for it. I'm really sorry. At 2 p.m. at Malone, and I'm told that that's always a very good day. And John Craig, who I personally want to thank at the last of these run of lectures during my presidency. I'll have a chance in October when Dr. Margaret Couples, who's sitting at the back and who'll be a very able next president, takes over, to thank John. But he's been amazingly efficient and good-humoured and well-organised. What more can I say? But it's been a real pleasure to have John do that. He'll take your name tonight for the golf competition. And then just to remember that the AGM will be in these rooms at 5 p.m. on Thursday the 27th of May. So thank you very much to the Ulster Society for the History of Medicine. And thank you, David, for a very good lecture. And thank you, everybody, for coming. There's tea and coffee afterwards. Please don't rush off. Stay and have a chat. And if you've got a question about the history of medicine here, I'm sure there'll be somebody here who can answer it for you. Thank you very much.